You're listening to a History Hub podcast. History Hub is based at the School of History at University College Dublin. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, and on SoundCloud. For more information and to listen to hundreds of podcasts, go to historyhub.ie. In this episode, the first of two podcasts from the Military Welfare History Network 2024 conference. The 2024 conference was kindly hosted by the University of Leeds and supported by initiatives and conference funding from the Economic History Society. This episode features a paper by Dr. Geoffrey Hayes from the University of Waterloo, who gave a paper entitled From Military Medicine to Health, The Challenge of Soldiers' Welfare in the Wartime Canadian Economy, 1939 to 1945.
So again, thank you to the organizers for the invitation and for the opportunity to talk about material that I've been thinking about for quite some time. So it's fun to be able to kind of pull your nose out of the archives and try to provide context. And already, as I will try to say, some of the ideas that I've heard already last night, this morning, I'm hoping to be able to develop a little bit more in this discussion. Some about 7 or 8 years ago, I went to the archives in Ottawa, which, as some of you may or may not know, is an onerous exercise for a variety of reasons. And I found in it a memorandum by a fellow named Brock Chisholm, who you may or may not have heard of, who was writing in November of 1944 to the Adjutant General of the Canadian Army, Harry Letson, asking that his directorate — he was the directorate of Canadian Army Medical Services — that his directorate be changed, that the name of it be changed to the Canadian Army Health Services. And this intrigued me. I didn't find any other references except some material that he had drawn from various health agencies and welfare agencies in Canada that largely endorsed the initiative, but it didn't seem to go anywhere. So in some respects, I'm telling you about a lost opportunity, and perhaps we could talk about counterfactual history, but it does raise some questions that I'll at least try to use to help organize my talk in the time I've got. It seemed in some ways a daring, perhaps even revolutionary proposal, and to my understanding anyway, the Canadian Armed Forces don't talk about health services until well into the 1990s. So he was well ahead of his time, it seemed, was Brock Chisholm, who I'll try to introduce to you briefly in a moment. But it even raises the question then of this whole idea of what prompted this. There was, it's clear, a whole series of initiatives that emerged, perhaps involuntarily from the Army side, to deal with the question of families and the question of long-term separation that often, in the Canadian case, went 6 or even more years. So the idea then of understanding this, it seems to me, is a study of gender. This is a study in which women, I think, play a considerable role, as I'll demonstrate. It is a study, as I suppose, and I'm still trying to wrap my head around it, of emotional communities, and I think that too can be played out in some of the discussion. It's the rise of experts and the rise of particularly two professions, the rise of psychology and the influence of psychologists who are breaking away from the departments of philosophy in Canadian universities, American and likely British too, but also the rise of social work as a profession as well. And we can see Brock Chisholm's influence in trying to bring those experts into the Canadian Army during wartime. And it is also, I think, speaks to what Paul mentioned to us earlier, and we referred to it already, as this kind of triangle of service people, their families, of the Army itself, of the state, as well as perhaps non-governmental organizations. This idea of who's going to look after families during the course of these long separations. So I bring to you at least a preliminary examination of some of this material. I think it is fascinating for what it perhaps suggests, for what might have come of it. But it's also clear that there are some considerable kinds of national and indeed international trends. The Canadians are in fact following an American model rather than a British one. So we'll see if we can make some general observations at the time I've got. As I was making this study, I realized that photograph has been something that I've shown students for about the last 30 years. And it may be familiar too. I don't know if it is, but it's a a photograph taken in Vancouver, New Westminster, BC, in October of 1940, and it quickly became syndicated. It was certainly syndicated in the American papers, and it was also, I believe, in British press as well. And it shows the members of a British Columbia, what will eventually become a tank regiment, marching down 8th Avenue in New Westminster, BC, in October of 1940. And there, that little boy, whose name is Warren Bernard, is breaking away from his mother, Bernice, in order to say goodbye to his father, Fred. There. Used to be, I get terribly choked up when I'd show this when my kids were little. I don't know why. Anyway, now I'm looking at it in a very different way, because I'm saying, why is this such an iconic photograph? And it speaks something to the kind of way in which we've romanticized this notion of how families became separated over the course of years. And it's remarkable, again, as I kind of followed the iconography, I guess, 10 years ago, I didn't even know this. We have loonies and toonies rather than pounds and dollars, but this is that a toonie or a loonie? I can't remember, but anyway, it's worth not very much. It's the Canadian commemorative 2014 coin, which shows the Bernard family there in their embrace. And it's also in a variety of other kinds of issues, in other kinds of public commemorations. But it's clear then that the problems that the Bernards were going to face, and I'll tell you about those problems in a moment at the end of my talk, is that it was clear that there were certainly social workers who themselves are trying to establish their credentials, separating themselves perhaps from religious organizations, trying to show academic rather than religious backgrounds. And this is Elizabeth Wallace writing early in the war, even before that photograph is taken, speaking to some of the kinds of problems that will potentially be faced as these family separations occur. And of course, in some ways, Elizabeth Wallace is quite prescient, and I'll refer to some of the other work that she makes through the war. The other person that and Wallace makes it very clear from this particular reference, this is to Milton Gregg, who wins the VC in the First World War, and at the beginning of the Second, he's in charge of the military district around Ottawa, Ontario. And I thought this was a particularly fascinating admission that the Army was more than willing to make sure all these matters were in the hands of social civilian organizations rather than the Army. But it's also fairly obvious from the beginning that families, particularly young women, who it seemed were getting into the troubles of having affairs and becoming pregnant, I'll leave him up for a second, were writing to various military authorities and making it very clear that these were not considered so much social issues as military issues, and that the Army needed to do something about this fellow who I slept with and whose son I'm now, or child I'm now carrying. How am I going to deal with this? And the other letters, which are fascinating in various files, are of mothers who are writing saying, well, what if, and they often would write it in a kind of, third person, you know, what would happen if a father is found to be unfaithful, has a child overseas, will that family in England be able to take veterans or dependents allowances, as they were then known, away from the families back in Canada? So these are the kinds of issues that were suddenly coming up, that in some ways it was clear that there were a variety of ways in which women were making sure that the military knew that these were problems, that they felt the military was responsible for. There's also a clear sense, too, that as social work and psychology moves into the Army, that there are notions about women, and you can see it in the previous slide, that women would become unfaithful. It didn't seem as if there was a concern about men becoming unfaithful. It was about women becoming unfaithful or somehow not being able to fulfill their motherly duties. And that becomes a response as well. This is Brock Chisholm, 1896 to 1971. Oakville psychiatrist at a time when there aren't many psychiatrists around. So his rise in the Canadian Army, sorry, these should be bigger, but the rise in the Canadian Army is fairly meteoric. He's a veteran of the First World War, but he's a fairly public figure in the 1930s in Toronto. He'll eventually become infamous for saying that it's wrong for parents to tell their children that Santa Claus exists. He's the guy who denounces Santa Claus, if you can imagine, which may well help kind of understand why he slipped out of the country and ends up at the WHO in 1948. He becomes head of personnel selection, where he brings in a growing number of psychologists, largely from McGill and Toronto, who are in charge of trying to figure out how to best to vet and select troops for the Canadian Army. And eventually, as I've noted, in 1942, quite a remarkable kind of promotion, he becomes the Director General of the Canadian Army Medical Corps, where he makes this claim. So he's an energetic figure. And I suppose a lot of my research is centered on who the heck is this guy, you know? And it's fascinating that when he makes that request to change the name of the Canadian Army Medical Corps, it's also the month he leaves the Army. So I'm not sure whether or not there's a kind of correlation there. I kind of suspect there is. So one of the things that Chisholm does by late 1941, early 1942, everyone by that stage is worried about the state of the war, particularly the performance of the British armies in the desert and in the Far East. And so morale becomes a central issue that, of course, I'm being able to study. The British respond by creating a British Army Morale Committee in early 1942. We take a slightly different approach, and Chisholm actually goes to a private company, which are, in fact, two recent graduates from McGill University, and he creates an opinion survey, not of the troops in Canada. And he finds basically three things. He finds that the army is deeply divided between conscripts and volunteers for reasons that we could go into. It also feels as if the third-class citizens to the Navy and the Air Force, the Navy and the Air Force have better uniforms in part. And thirdly, at least two out of five of the soldiers polled say they're deeply concerned about their families. So that becomes, and in subsequent surveys, which I'm just now uncovering really for the first time, this issue about family separation is clearly a central focus of how they're dealing with the issue of morale. The response to the survey justifies the creation of a Directorate of Social Science. No, it isn't. It's a Directorate of Special Services. There we are. And I've been fascinated by this particular organization now for far too many years. They're trying, in a way, to become a clearinghouse for all issues related to morale. And one of the issues that they're coming up with is not so much that people aren't getting letters from home, which are a central part of the morale link between home front and the war, but they're actually finding that the letters themselves are causing upset, particularly as wives are writing about and complaining perhaps about their situation, complaining about having to live with mothers-in-law, or complaining about errant children. So the plan that emerges out of DSS in early 1942 is, well, again, it's, of course, the wives who are at fault here. So why not create an ad campaign that will encourage people to write friendly, grateful letters, letters that don't simply complain, letters that speak to the soldier's experience. So this poor little guy, great kind of middle class thing, you know, in which you're trying to create the image of a kind of ideal family. Things could be falling apart, but you just tell them, you know, dear dad, things are fine. I fell off my bike, but my head isn't as badly wounded as it looks. So, you know, this friendly letters campaign is just one element that seems to emerge in the context of trying to define morale and trying to define this connection. What we also find, as I say, is that we're drawing heavily. The Directorate of Special Services is in some ways a miniature copy of the Division of Special Services that the United States Ground Forces have created. And what we find here is that you might well know the work of Samuel Stouffer. There's a wonderful website, of course, that's now kind of drawn all this material together for the first time. And this is actually the first published issue in the American Forces of a feature called What the Soldier Thinks. And it's created at the behest of the chief of staff in the U.S. forces, and it's published widely. What I found was that the Canadians are doing the same thing. They've actually started it before the American, but the Canadians don't publish it. In fact, it took me a hell of a long time to figure out where they were, buried in the microfilm and archives. But this does become a kind of ongoing series of polls and surveys that are trying to figure out what it is that soldiers like and dislike about the Army. That's a fairly long list. And also this whole question about family separation, which continues to show up. So what the Canadian soldier thinks, again, reveals that in the extent of personal and family problems, which are identified by 42 and 43, the fact that two men in every five state that they've been seriously worried about personal or family problems during the past 2 or 3 months is disquieting. That really is a subject of some concern for Army planners and Army staff or Army leadership in a variety of ways. So the issues then of, The issue then is addressed through a variety of ways. Another social worker who becomes a prominent figure in the Canadian Army is named Stuart Sutton, who will go on to work for the United Nations in the 1950s. And Stuart Sutton, in fact, has a link with Mackenzie King, the Canadian Prime Minister, in that they both work for Jane Addams at Hull House in Chicago before Jane Addams dies in 1935. And Sutton is a clever guy in the sense that he's writing to the Prime Minister as early as 1939 saying, you know, you worked with Jane Addams and that's in the Settlement House projects. This should, be attractive to someone who's trying to deal with the social problems of the Army. He eventually, by 1944, will become himself the head of another directorate. Sorry about all these directorates. That'll be called the Directorate of Special Services. And essentially what he's doing is bringing social workers, he'll call them social service officers, into the Army. Great stuff. Okay. So suddenly, as a profession, suddenly you can see them sort of making their way into the Canadian Army. What will they do? Well, initially, social work is often seen as a gendered activity in many respects. One Marjorie Keyes, newly commissioned into the Army, will go into the enlistment centers in downtown Toronto in late 1942 and enact a kind of experiment in which the psychiatrists who are selecting or trying to weed out enlistees, that Marjorie Keyes will go into her inventory, her catalog, her connections of social work, of welfare agencies to try to find the origins of some of the issues over which psychiatrists are preventing people from going into the Army. So in that sense, social work kind of represents an interesting tension. It's not so much about fixing these problems as much as trying to make sure that these people could perhaps be eligible in some capacity to join the Army. This develops then through 1943 and 1944. Brock Chisholm, as I say, makes this proposal in December of 1944, which is quite late, of course. I think what happens, and I'm only speculating here, is that Chisholm probably jumps the gun and maybe plays his hand a little bit too hard. He actually goes to a variety of welfare agencies and asks them their opinion as to whether or not the Director General of Medical Services should become Health Services. And most of them say, yeah, it's a great idea, but I realized my timing was a little off in the sense that you don't usually go to your external sources before you ask the person in charge of their permission. I do think that perhaps might well have helped end Brock Chisholm's military career. So perhaps the story ends there, but it doesn't. By 1944 and 45, another issue is showing up, another troop survey of really quite discontented soldiers coming back from Great Britain, many of them then with a great sense of anxiety, perhaps even anger about the home front, that their problems aren't being understood. There's a sense that they've become de-Canadianized, to use one phrase. In other words, they've got more to do and more in common with their British colleagues and the British citizens than they would with Canada, where they've often been away for many, many years. Canada had the worst leave policy of all Allied armies, as far as I can tell. So it's clear that as late as 1945, as much as we don't have this Directorate General of Health Services, we do have growing numbers of social service officers, social workers in uniform. So you've got then suddenly people throughout the military districts trying to deal with the problems of bringing people back home, the problems of repatriation, the problems of trying to bring families back together, the discoveries of unwanted pregnancies, the problems perhaps of long family separation. So is this an experiment that just should be set aside? I don't think so, because it does speak, I think, to the broader issues of how the Army, in some respects, tried to deal with the complexity, if for nothing else, of the problem of family separation in wartime. I think it's significant enough that I flew across the ocean to tell you about it. So there, that justifies it right there. I'll leave you with this. They wanted to go and make a reunion photograph in 1945 in February, and there's now 5-year-old come 10-year-old Warren Whitey Bernard, and they set this all up because they knew this photograph would be taken well. And there he is in the hands of his father, Frank, who had a tank brewed up around him in Normandy. He'd gone home on a compassionate leave in 1943, and not soon after, he and his wife divorce. So it does again speak to these kinds of quite remarkable ways in which we've perhaps romanticized, perhaps not even tried to understand the complexities of family separation during the Second World War.
Thanks for listening to this History Hub podcast. History Hub is based at the School of History at University College Dublin. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, and on SoundCloud. For more information and to listen to hundreds of podcasts, go to historyhub.ie.